This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time, and Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top story is former U.S. President Donald Trump, who has survived a second impeachment trial, says his patriotic movement has just begun. China hits back at the U.S. for raising concerns about the World Health Organization's report on the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. Also ahead this hour, protesters once again rally in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to voice their anger the government's COVID restrictions. Welcome to the World News. The U.S. Senate votes to acquit former President Trump, sparing him from conviction in his second impeachment trial in a year.
The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, former President of the United States, upon one article of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present, not having found him guilty of the charge contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charge in said article.
The upper chamber of the Congress voted 57 guilty against 43 not guilty. That fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to convict Trump. He was accused of inciting an insurrection on the Capitol last month, as lawmakers were certifying Joe Biden as the next president. Despite his acquittal, a bipartisan majority cast votes found Trump guilty. In a statement, Trump, however, called the trial the greatest witch hunt in the U.S. history. He added that his political movement, quote, has just begun. But Biden said the substance of the charges against Trump is not in question, despite his acquittal. That was echoed by Senate Republican Mitch McConnell.
Against him,
there's no question. None. That President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it.
Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer also slammed a vote to exonerate Trump as un-American. He said the 43 senators who voted not guilty will forever be linked to Trump's, quote, terrible legacy. Democrats had warned that acquitting the former president would open the door for future presidents to violate their office in the final weeks of their presidency without suffering any accountability. Earlier, we were joined by our man in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, who briefed us on the outcome of Trump's impeachment trial.
The Senate voted to acquit the president, and the former president, and I think that was to be expected. This whole week, we've been listening to testimony from both sides and the widespread criticism of the former president's defense team as they cobbled together an argument that at times seemed rambling and unfocused, but at other times just seemed somewhat sophomoric, especially in the montage of the word fight, which was part of their defense. The whole time, people knew, most everyone knew, that the president, former president, would be acquitted and that he would not be convicted. There are only 7 Republicans who joined Democrats, far short of the 17 that they needed. And I believe that many didn't even think that they would get 7 at times. There was this argument that the former president couldn't be put on trial because he was not the president anymore, and impeachment was focused on presidents or people who are still holding office. But there was precedent that had already been set that not everyone who is found guilty to be impeached needed to be in office. But the Republicans largely did not want to believe that. They did not want to accept that in part of their decision making. And one could only think that it's mostly partisan, that they still wanted to show that they were in alignment with Trump, that they supported the Republican Party, and they didn't want to face a lot of their constituents who they would have a lot of questions to answer if they had voted to convict former President Trump.
U.S. President Joe Biden's aide T.J. Ducklow has resigned, becoming the first White House staffer to leave since the new administration took office. The White House said it has accepted the resignation of Ducklow, who was suspended for 1 week without pay. Ducklow, who worked as White House deputy spokesman, handed over his resignation after threatening to destroy a reporter who had asked him about his personal life. The White House said the new administration is committed to striving every day to meet the standards set by the president in treating others with dignity and respect. Ducklow later apologized to the reporter, calling the language he used abhorrent, disrespectful, and unacceptable. China fires back at Washington for raising concerns about the World Health Organization's report about the origins of COVID-19. Beijing accused Washington of harming multilateral cooperation between the two countries and even damaging the WHO in recent years. It also urged Washington to stop pointing fingers at China and other countries that supported the world body during the pandemic. Beijing welcomed Washington's decision to re-engage with the WHO. It, however, called on the U.S. to hold itself to the highest standards instead of taking aim at other countries. This comes after U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan called on China to make available data from the earliest days of the COVID-19 outbreak. He expressed concern about the way the findings of the WHO's investigation were communicated. We were earlier joined by our Beijing correspondent, Stephen Ribe, to talk more about the simmering row between China and the U.S. over the World Health Organization's probe into COVID origins.
I see it as making 2 overall arguments. The first argument is that the U.S. has not been supporting the WHO. This is supposed to be a multilateral, a joint effort by everybody to prevent future outbreaks. The only way that future outbreaks of a virus such as this one will be prevented from turning into a global pandemic is if all countries cooperate together. The mechanism for that is the WHO. The US, under President Trump, said it was going to withdraw from the WHO and cut funding. The British Lancet magazine, medical magazine, pointed out that that is actually unlawful. It violates a resolution that the US made under Harry Truman, President Harry Truman, when it joined the WHO in 1948. So that's one argument. The second broad argument that China is making is that the US has a massive ulterior motive in this whole exercise, and that is to turn public opinion against China.
Brazil reports more than 1,000 new COVID-19 related deaths as the Americas struggles To contain the coronavirus pandemic, Brazil still has the world's second largest coronavirus death toll in more than 238,000 fatalities. South American nation also reported over 44,000 new confirmed cases, raising the total tally to more than 9.8 million. Meanwhile, COVID-19 infections and deaths continue to surge in the U.S. despite the country's vaccination program. According to Johns Hopkins University, the virus has infected over 27.5 million people and claimed more than 483,000 lives in the world's worst-hit country. U.S. health officials say out of nearly 70 million vaccines distributed, some 50 million have so far been administered. Protesters have taken to the streets of the Austrian capital of Vienna in defiance of a police ban to demonstrate against the government's COVID restrictions. At least two police officers were injured as they attempted to disperse the crowd. Demonstrators said they were against wearing face masks and did not want their children to take mandatory COVID tests in schools. Homa Lesgi explains.
Protesters hold a huge rally in Vienna's city center, defying a police ban on what's become regular rallies in Austria against the government-imposed restrictions to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Police put the official number of protesters at 2,000, but organizers said there were much more people, many of whom were forcefully barred from joining the bigger rallies.
Despite the police ban, thousands have been taking part in demonstrations like this over the past weeks. It looks like the arrests that have been made by the police during this time has done little to deter these crowds.
Many of the demonstrators said they were against the recently announced rule for older school children to take mandatory COVID tests and wear masks in school.
They have to test, they have to wear masks, they can't breathe and all this madness they have to do at school. And they have to stop now because they destroy actually our children. And the children, they are sick now in the brain because of all this madness going on here. And not because of the virus. They are sick because of the politicians.
Most of the protesters did not wear masks and were vocal in their dismissal.
There is no valid evaluation behind this. That the government can say this is the reason when we do not use it that we get sick, and this is absolutely nonsense.
Local media said protesters included high-profile members of far-right and neo-Nazi groups. Several people were arrested and at least two police officers were injured. The government's management of the COVID crisis has also been criticized by industrial groups who argue the restrictions are killing jobs, growth and wealth. For now, with infections still high, the government has decided to keep hotels and restaurants closed while reopening schools, shops and services. Homa Lesgi, Vienna.
Catalonia has prepared ballot boxes, votes and health measures for a controversial election amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. The latest polls show pro-independence parties neck and neck with pro-Spanish unity parties. Kusai Kedri reports.
Catalonia votes Sunday to elect the 135-seat regional parliament after a court ruled against the postponement of the election due to the lingering coronavirus pandemic. In Barcelona, election officials rushed to turn municipal markets, sports halls, and every available public space into makeshift polling locations.
We have 365 polling stations, 94 more than the last election, and a total of 1,929 ballot points. We have deployed 4,300 ballot boxes, 1.8 million ballot papers, 4,000 tables, 7,000 liters of hand sanitizers, and 10,000 face masks.
Some health experts have expressed doubt about Sunday's vote as the region hit the 20,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic. Despite efforts to minimize the risk of infection, many voters remain skeptical.
I am still thinking about voting. I don't believe this is the right time to vote because we are in the midst of a pandemic. It doesn't make sense that they call on people to vote while there are restrictions on movements and while businesses are shut down.
Political parties wrapped up their campaigning Friday amid deep divisions in the pro-independence camp. Republican Left Party leader Oriol Junqueras, who is serving a jail sentence for the 2017 referendum, was allowed to leave prison to campaign for his party's pick for president. He urged followers to vote to counter the rise of the far right in the region.
Many militants from this party have fought Nazism and fascism across Europe. Many have carried the fight against Franco during the darkest years. Many have fought for democracy and independence when no one stood the guard.
His main rival in the pro-Spanish unity camp, former Health Minister Salvador Illa, promised to put an end to the separatist stranglehold on power in Catalonia.
Our alternative is the only constructive solution which says enough of the same, which wants to turn the page and which will not fail you.
Although they spent much of the campaign denigrating each other, the two main pro-independence parties Wednesday signed an agreement in which they pledged not to seek any coalition with the socialists to form a government.
In the last stretch of what has been largely described as a precipitated election, the latest polls still show the top three parties in a dead heat. The projected abstention rate and voter indecisiveness could dramatically shift the outcome of the vote. Kusai Kedri, Barcelona.
Take you to Bahrain, where people there have staged nationwide demonstrations on the eve of the 10th anniversary of the popular uprising against the Al Khalifa regime. Protests were held in several towns and villages near the capital, Manama. People called for an end to human rights violations and the release of political prisoners. They urged the Al Khalifa regime to relinquish power and allow the establishment of a just system. Meanwhile, Bahrain's top cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, says the opposition movement in the country will not let up until final victory is achieved in the face of the regime's crackdown.
With time, we can see that people have continued their uprising and they continue to achieve their aspirations and their demands, and they have a great aspiration in order to reach their demands, no matter how long it would take, no matter how harsh the oppression is, and no matter what the circumstances.
Sheikh Isa Qasim made the comments in a live address from the Iranian city of Qom. He said the uprising seeks to rectify the wrongdoings of the Al Khalifa regime. The top cleric said Bahraini people want to take control of their own country and resources. Bahrainis have been staging demonstrations on a regular basis since a popular uprising began there in mid-February of 2011. However, the regime has brutally suppressed the protests and has arrested, injured, and killed thousands of people in the tiny island nation. Political analyst Zafar Bangash says Western countries should support Bahraini protesters' demands and stop backing the Al Khalifa regime.
Well, first of all, as I mentioned, that there are Saudi forces also operating there. And prior to this year, the Saudis, of course, were also looked upon with great favor by the West. But the most crucial point, of course, is that Bahrain happens to be the base of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. And the United States, of course, wishes to keep that Fifth Fleet over there, because as a result of the Fifth Fleet, it is able to destabilize the region and terrorize people in the region. And so it serves America's interest to keep this regime in power so that America's Fifth Fleet can continue to operate from there. And I think it is time that the rest of the world took note of it and stood shoulder to shoulder with the people of Bahrain to give them their legitimate rights as well.
The UN Food Agency says a record 12.4 million people in Syria are struggling to find enough food to eat. The World Food Program says the figure means 60% of the population in that war-torn country is now food insecure. WFP spokeswoman Jessica Lawson says it is alarming that a basic meal is now beyond the reach of the majority of Syrian families. A decade of war and militancy has ravaged the Syrian economy and sent inflation rates soaring across the country. The Syrian conflict has killed more than 387,000 people and displaced millions more since it began in 2011.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
in the limelight.
The lack of critical coverage of Biden's new announcement suggests that corporate media will no longer be as concerned about kids in cages. Now the preferred candidate is in the White House, says Alan McLeod, writer, in an article published under the heading From Concentration Camps to Overflow Facilities. With Biden in charge, media forgets kids in cages. Stay tuned for the details, please. The Biden administration is opening a new child prison along the United States-Mexico border. The center, located in Carrizo Springs, around 100 miles southwest of San Antonio, is being specifically built for unaccompanied migrant children attempting to cross the border and will hold around 700 people when finished, although plans noted it will be expanded if the government deems it necessary. But corporate media do not see it that way. While the Trump years were filled with stories about kids in cages and ICE concentration camps along the border, they have instead almost universally referred to the new project as an overflow facility to help migrant children, as the following headlines demonstrate. For example, CNN says, Biden administration prepares to open overflow facility for migrant children. Or New York Post says, Biden administration to open overflow facility for 700 migrant children. USA Today says, Biden administration to house migrant teens at overflow facility in Texas closed under Trump. Or Yahoo News says, Biden administration to open migrant overflow facility amid increase in unaccompanied migrant apprehensions. CBS says, Biden administration prepares to open overflow facility for migrant children. Overflow facility is a distinctly pleasantly sounding term for such an establishment, suggesting links to positively charged services like swimming pools or libraries. The phrase is a completely new way to refer to prisons. A new search for overflow facility pre-January 2021 brings up only stories about COVID overflow clinics or emergency sewage treatment works. The phrase concentration camp to describe the structure was completely absent. Perhaps the worst offender, however, was Fox News, whose headline informed readers, Biden administration to open overflow shelter for migrant children in Texas, a framing that invites the audience to see the move as a humanitarian gesture along the lines of rape crisis shelters. None of the children who will be sent there will go of their own free will, and it is doubtful whether many will appreciate the shelter that the U.S. government will provide them. Over much of the past 3 years, corporate media have been comparing the detention centers on the border to concentration camps, if not directly labeling them as such. For example, CNN, Esquire, Washington Post. Data from Google Trends show that phrases like ICE concentration camp will barely used until 2018, the term exploding into public consciousness a year later, especially after prominent Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez began using it. President Biden has promised to rein in many of the worst excessive IC policy, yet the organization's role in society will not fundamentally change. Indeed, during the time he was vice president, President Obama deported well over 2.5 million people through immigration orders, more than any other president in American history, earning him the moniker Deporter-in-Chief from critics. President Trump actually deported fewer migrants than Obama, although he drastically sharpened his rhetoric against them and encouraged ICE to carry out a campaign of intimidation against the population nationwide and attempting to prosecute activists who helped migrants survive the perilous desert crossing. And while Trump politicized and made the border wall a central part of his administration, hundreds of miles of the wall had already been built by previous presidents, as filmmaker Abby Martin documented. Missing from so much of the coverage, whether pro or anti-border wall, however, is the context to why so many people are leaving Central America to go northwards in the first place. When corporate media do offer explanations, they have been relatively shallow, merely noting that they are searching for employment, fleeing discrimination, or following a dream. In reality, economic and political factors largely account for the enormous migration, many of which have been their origins in decisions taken in Washington, D.C. Free trade deals signed with developing countries such as NAFTA decimated local agriculture, as a small-scale farmer suddenly had to compete with massive U.S. government-subsidized agribusiness, leading to a collapse in the Mexican rural economy and a huge influx of people into the country's largest cities. Meanwhile, the Obama administration's decision to overthrow the government of Honduras in 2009 led to a military dictatorship, persecution on a national scale, and a mass exodus from the country. In neighboring Nicaragua, by comparison, the U.S. has tried but failed to remove the Sandinista government. As a result, immigration from Nicaragua has been minimal. The lack of critical coverage of Biden's new announcement suggests that corporate media will no longer be as concerned about kids in cages. Now, their preferred candidate is in the White House. Perhaps they never cared at all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979 was a monumental event in many aspects, with long-lasting effects still felt to this day. Let's take a look at how this movement, whose seeds were sown at the turn of the 20th century, sprung up and rose to defeat colonialism. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. To better understand the roots of Iran's Islamic Revolution, we have to go back in time to the beginning of the 20th century. This is when the British Empire was at its height, with around a quarter of the world's entire population, under its rule and around a quarter of the Earth's landmass under its dominion. At this time, the British were occupying India, Australia, Canada, and vast swaths of Africa. One place that wasn't officially part of the empire, but in practical terms very much under its rule, is in fact Iran, with the Russian Empire occupying the northern part of Iran and the British exerting their sphere of influence over the southern part of Iran. Now, as with many imperialist endeavors, a lot of the story has to do with natural resources, particularly oil. In 1908, oil was discovered in Iran. A British company known back then as Burma Oil founded a subsidiary company called the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. This Anglo-Persian Oil Company installed its first pipeline just 1 year later in 1909 and built an enormous refinery in Abadan, which was completed later in 1912. And from that moment on, this company in Britain effectively began stealing oil from the Iranian people for the next decades. Former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, at the time, was First Lord of the Admiralty and in charge of the British Royal Navy. He realized what a lucrative gold mine this was. He convinced the British government to buy an ownership share in the Anglo-Persian Oil Company in 1914, and he transitioned the Royal Navy's fleets from coal to petroleum, which proved to be of immense use in World War I and World War II, when the British Navy was the envy of other empires at the time. The British, however, took the Iranians for granted and gave them crumbs. Iran received a mere 16% of all oil revenue for its own oil. If that wasn't bad enough, this tiny amount of 16% was calculated by the United Kingdom's government in private without ever showing the Iranians the books. And on top of that, this was done after taxes had already been paid by the British government to the British government. This blatant theft and plundering of Iran's natural resources became common knowledge, and people rightfully resented the British and their colonial arrogance. Now, in the years after World War II, there was one politician who would soon put an end to this. His name was Mohammad Mossadegh. Mossadegh was known for wanting to nationalize Iran's oil fields, and just like many Iranians, held a grudge against the 1933 agreement made by Reza Shah, which gave enormous concessions to the British to continue plundering the oil at Abadan. Mossadegh was appointed prime minister in 1951, and soon thereafter, Iran's parliament moved to nationalize all of Iran's oil fields, including Abadan, which at this point, keep in mind, Abadan was the largest oil refinery in the world. That should give you an idea of how badly the British wanted to keep their hands on it. They opted instead to stop Iran from controlling and using its own oil refineries through means of sabotage and other clandestine operations. An embargo or blockade was also imposed on Iran to stop it from being able to sell its own oil on the global market. The British felt that they had been robbed somehow because they had discovered the oil, they had built the refineries, and they had developed Abadan. This is, of course, absurd, but the British would not accept this condition for long, and instead they resorted to the typical dirty tactics used by imperialists. They plotted a coup. The British called it Operation Boot. Meanwhile, the Americans, who were helping them, referred to it as Operation Ajax. The goal was to oust Mossadegh and reinstall the Shah and retake the oil. Now, while people often attribute the coup of 1953 to the CIA, and that's partly correct, the role of the British cannot be overlooked. We know, for example, that Mossadegh's chief of police, Mahmoud Afshartus, was kidnapped, tortured, and executed by Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6. Once this coup was completed and Mossadegh was deposed, the Americans and British moved quickly to help the Shah establish and train the SAVAK, Iran's secret police. The SAVAK were trained by the CIA, who had lots of experience training people in torture all over the world, in Jakarta, in Latin America, as part of their Cold War campaign against communists. Now, the CIA, in training the SAVAK, taught them how to repress dissidents, activists, and anyone who opposed the Shah. This is collectively remembered in Iran as a period of immense struggle and great suffering. The CIA did finally release documents titled The Battle for Iran, showing its involvement in the coup of 1953. The United Kingdom, however, to this day, maintains secrecy regarding the matter and has still not owned up or confessed to its damning role in the overthrow of Mossadegh. Joining me is Navid Zarinal, doctoral candidate and researcher at Columbia University. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show, Navid. It's a pleasure to have you.
Sure. Happy to be on the show, Richard.
So oil was one of the most lucrative things for the British Empire in Iran, and Mossadegh's nationalization represented a threat for them. What are some of the other things that aren't very much talked about, the other economic and political reasons for which the UK backed the Shah along with the US?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as you correctly say, the support of the UK for the Shah was based on oil, and Mossadegh wanted to nationalize the oil. So the British and to a lesser extent the Americans were upset about that, and they backed the Shah in opposition to Mossadegh. So that was one reason, but as the years went by, actually Iran got more concessions regarding sovereignty on oil. So a big reason, another reason that the UK and the US and also the West more generally backed the Shah was because the Shah was a big ally against anti-imperialist movements in the region and perhaps in the world at large. And also he was not a big annoyance when it came to the question of Zionism and Palestinian independence. And there's actually, I think, a good analogy to be made here to the SARS. So before the Russian Revolution, a lot of the anti-imperialist and progressive movements in the world were opposed to the SARS, the Russians. And in a similar way, in this period, so from 1950s onward to the present day, I would say a lot of the anti-imperialist movements are opposed to the US and the UK and the West more generally. And the Shah, since he was friendly to the US and the UK, he could be used as an instrument against these anti-imperialist movements.
Right. And a lot of people in Iran, they remember this period for its brutal repression. One of the most notable events, perhaps, is referred to as Black Friday. Can you maybe elaborate on that for us, as well as the secret police, the Savak, and just in general, how political dissidents were treated and what the climate was like under the Shah?
That's right. So there were numerous demonstrations preceding the revolution, and there was one very famous protest known as Black Friday in English nomenclature, and it happened in what was called the Jalé Square at the time, and they changed the name after the revolution to the Martyrs Square or Maidan Shohada. In this demonstration, the Shah's forces killed a number of people in this Black Friday demonstration, so it became a big event after the revolution that's remembered every year. Black Friday was an example of the wide variety of demonstrations that were happening, and also it indicated the high participation in the Iranian revolution, because if you look at the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, or coming even more forward, the Romanian Revolution of 1989, the participation usually was about a couple percent. It wasn't very high. But in the Iranian Revolution, the estimates are that 10% of the population marched and actively participated in making their revolution. And regarding the second part of your question, regarding the Savak or the secret police, so just as Shah security forces were on the streets containing the protests, the Savak would also gather intelligence, and they were also close to imperialist US, and they had a close eye on the activists and the dissidents. But what's interesting is that the Shahs generally gave more space to the Islamic dissent to operate, and they were harsher on the socialist, Marxist, and leftist dissent. An example, I think this is a very powerful example of Shah's surveillance state and how his state would treat dissidents and revolutionary opposition. There was a program connected to the state that was called Goftegu, which means conversation, and very similar to what you and I are having, Richard. There was a conversation between an anchor and a dissident who was in prison, and they would bring the prisoner on the show, and they were forced recantation. So the dissident had to recant on live TV. And there was one particular short story writer and cultural critic named Ghulam Hossein Saidi, who was tortured in prison, and then he was forced to come on this program called Goftegu, and there he had to recant the things like the criticism of the Shah's government that he had made. And there's a very memorable line by a poet named Ahmad Shamlu about what happened to Saidi, because he also committed suicide eventually. And what Shamlu said is that what said, I'll read it to you, quoting Shamlu, what said farewell to Shah's prison was merely a half-living corpse. That man with his wondrous creativity, after the bodily and mostly mental tortures of Evin prison, became utterly lifeless.
Many in the West, especially the United States, when they think of the Iranian Revolution, they always see it through the lens of the hostage crisis, right? For example, this film with Ben Affleck, Argo, which they even won an Oscar for, you know, the whole Hollywood propaganda. Can you tell us why that's a faux lens to see the revolution through and why this misses the bigger picture here?
That's right. It is a very U.S.-centric view to look at one of the biggest and most important revolutions of the 20th century. And as we discussed earlier, the real reason for a revolution was the imperialist support for the Shah that brought the crisis of legitimacy for the Shah. And then I think a reason might have been anxieties by the revolutionaries that, just as in 1953, the U.S. orchestrated a coup d'etat against Mossadegh, again, the U.S. could intervene in Iranian affairs. It's just a very minor event in the revolution, but from the American point of view, it became the event of the Iranian revolution. And as you said, it was represented in really terrible films like Argo. And if you actually look at the DVD cover, the Blu-ray cover for Argo, you see Ben Affleck looking very contemplative and rational, looking in the distance. But then the Iran revolutionaries almost look like zombies. They're holding things and, you know, they're kind of, there's just a collective of them looking very scary and menacing, about to come and harm people. So it's interesting that even though Ben Affleck seems to be a nice anti-Orientalist, I mean, we saw in Bill Maher, he actually defended Muslims against Bill Maher's Islamophobia. But these kind of representations, when it comes to political difference, are still very much part of the American consciousness.
In the aftermath of the revolution, how did the West react, especially the U.S. and the U.K., both in the short term and in the long term, to try and undermine Iran after they suddenly lost control of their puppet monarch?
Yeah, so I think the attempts to sabotage the revolution started from early on. I mean, I think we can look to the example of the Iraq-Iran war as a very unfortunate war that was devastating for both countries. And I think the West was using Saddam Hussein as a way to weaken and sabotage the revolution. But I think even the bigger attempts to sabotage the revolution came through such things as a currency sabotage. So since Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal, basically Iranian currency has collapsed, and that makes it very difficult to actually bring foreign imports in. And also the effect of sanctions. The problem is that when Iran has a difficult time transacting in the international banking system, it's very difficult to get medicines in. But what's, I think, really important to keep in mind, that despite the American attempt to sabotage the Iranian revolution, Iran has a very strong national production industry, and that has allowed it to withstand the American so-called maximum pressure.
Speaking more broadly, what are the main anti-imperialist values and lessons that the revolution brought with it, and how have they permeated in Iranian society and remained throughout the last four decades?
I would say a big value of the Iranian revolution is that it's providing an alternative to the globalization that is led by the U.S. and multinational corporations that I'm speaking of, is that there's a uniformity in our taste in leisure, in our economic choices, in our political models. So everything is becoming uniform. But the thing about Iran is that when people travel here, they actually see the political and economic difference here. So I think the political model is very different. So theocratic democracy is what I would describe it as. And the thing is, because our cognition, our political cognition is so Eurocentric, we see that as an oxymoron. But the thing is, I think they can be reconciled. Just as you can reconcile equality and liberty under liberalism, I think it's very doable to reconcile theocracy with democracy. And I think that's also an interesting Iranian experiment, an alternative to the European models that have been universalized since colonialism. So even though you do have things like class inequality, and one of the biggest aspirations of the Iranian revolution was class equality, but unfortunately that has been much more difficult to achieve. But despite this, there is still an alternative to the globalized neoliberal model that the U.S. and multinational corporations are pursuing. And you see that, I think, when you travel here. And I think a second important value and legacy of the Iranian revolution has been the support for the Palestinian cause. And I actually see this as an ideological and also moral commitment to Palestine and the Palestinian people. And that was an early aspiration of a revolution that has persisted to the present day.
When we talk about the axis of resistance, you know, we talk about Iran, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and Iran has supported all these various resistance movements, and actually not just in the Middle East, but even with Venezuela, this partnership and alliance. Can we argue that this is very much indeed one of the main values spurred on by the revolution? And how is it that Iran has, you know, become this backbone of these anti-imperialist efforts?
The support for resistance to imperialism is definitely a value of the Iranian revolution that we see both in ideology and in a state practice. And again, I think, I mean, it definitely has a geopolitical element to it, but I think a big part of it is ideological, philosophical, and ethical. And I think, as you correctly mentioned too, it's not, you know, because, you know, in the Western media, the representation is that whoever is Shia, Iran just supports them, so they turn it into a sectarian issue. But as you mentioned, I mean, Venezuela, I don't think they have too many Shias, but Iran is a big supporter of Venezuela. So I think it's an ideological and ethical commitment against imperialism, and because of this, they are supporting a resistance movement against imperialism. And it's not easy to do. It comes at a big cost to the country, for example, the sanctions, but it is something that the Iranian revolution is committed to.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
After the coup in Iran in 1953, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company changed its name to something that many of you are familiar with, British Petroleum, or BP. And when the U.S. carried out another coup the following year in Guatemala to depose of the democratically elected President Arbenz, another multinational was also at the heart of this dispute, United Fruit Company. And they also rebranded and changed their name afterwards to Chiquita Brands International. Now, while these corporations change their names and try to rebrand, the tactic remains very much the same, and we continue to see a lot of the same covert means and clandestine operations being used by the United States and the United Kingdom to overthrow other governments just for the sake of stealing their resources. As they say, war is a racket. Now, when the Islamic Revolution came about decades later, this changed everything and shocked the world. All of a sudden, the Shah, a puppet monarch loyal to the West, was overthrown and replaced by an Islamic Republic that was opposed to the West and to Israel. But it's important to note that this didn't happen overnight. Protests and movements to oppose the Shah started already in late 1977 and grew steadily with a coalition of students, leftists, Islamists. This broad coalition is a very important factor to which the success of the revolution can be attributed to, and shows the plurality of the uprising by the Iranian people against the Western-backed monarchy. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians, millions in fact, took to the streets in mass protests, prompting the Shah to declare martial law and impose a curfew. This repression became especially violent during this period, with one of the most horrific moments being the fire at Cinema Rex, which was quite frankly, a terrorist attack with over 400 people burned to death inside of a movie theater by four men working under orders of the SAVAK, the secret police. Another instance referred to in English as Black Friday was at Jaleh Square, now named Martyr Square, where the Shah's troops gunned down hundreds of protesters. It would only be a matter of months in January of 1979 until the Shah would leave Iran like a coward, pretending that he was going on vacation. He actually never returned. He stayed there in exile until his death. Shortly thereafter, Imam Khomeini finally returned to Iran on February 1st of 1979, greeted by jubilant crowds after spending 15 years in exile. In fact, over a million Iranians flocked to the streets in a show of support. Widely regarded as both the spiritual and the de facto leader of the revolution, an Islamic Republic was established through a national referendum and the adoption of a constitution under Imam Khomeini as Iran's first leader. And this marked the beginning of a whole new era for the nation. Finally, after decades of rule under a Western-backed puppet sponsored by the US and the UK, Iranians had now finally reclaimed their country by taking to the streets in the millions, voting in a new constitution and establishing a new Islamic Republic. And of course, with that said, Iranians, of course, regained sovereignty not just over their nation, but also over their natural resources, including the oil, which the British had plundered for so long. So, again, when we talk about the Islamic Revolution of 1979, it's really important to also talk about the history behind it, about the role that the United States and the United Kingdom played in the coups in 1953 by installing the Shah, who betrayed his country's riches to these multinational corporations and brutally repressed the Iranian people. This is a very, very important part of history that many Americans and many British do not understand, let alone know of. They have hardly any clue of the atrocities, the countless coups, interventions, the meddling, and all the nefarious covert operations that their governments carry out all across the world in their names. From their point of view, Iranian history starts in 1979, and that's all they know, and it's completely awash with anti-Oriental propaganda which seeks to demonize Iran. The truth is that Iran's revolution represented a landmark moment, the awakening of a movement, and the will of the people to fight and regain their sovereignty from the West. This caused a huge upset for Western governments and the multinationals that run them behind the scenes. In reality, Britain and the United States don't want other countries to be democracies. They want other countries that they can control, both politically and economically. Only then are those countries considered allies. You know, when nations like Iran, who are not only resource-rich, but rich in culture and history, actually stand up for themselves, it is extremely embarrassing for the suits in Whitehall and Capitol Hill who think that they are above everyone else. Iran's Islamic Revolution wasn't just an upheaval of Iran's political climate, it was also an act of defiance and an act of anti-imperialism. This idea of standing up to oppressors is something that is very deeply ingrained in Iran's culture, and this is not just something we see internally, but also internationally. Iran has been an ally and helped to liberate my country of Syria from the various jihadist groups and the scourge of foreign terrorists that once again Britain and the United States have financed along with Saudi Arabia and others. And equally, since the revolution, Iran has helped Lebanon and Palestine in their resistance against the Zionist occupation and in the protection of their lands. And more recently, we see in Iraq and Venezuela how Iran has helped these nations stand up against foreign invaders and imperialism. This is very important for people to understand, and it also explains why the West has held a grudge against Iran ever since it broke free from Occidental rule, seeking to cripple it always with sanctions, with war, with intimidation. Now, not just because Iranians took back control of their country, but also because they outmaneuver and help other resistant movements regionally and globally, and help other people stand up for themselves. Sure, there's no such thing as a perfect country or a perfect political system in the world. But there is something to be said about a nation and a people that are brave enough to stand up to tyranny, to colonization, to white supremacy, and then help their brothers and sisters elsewhere to do the same. It is a remarkable feat of resistance and anti-imperialism, and why Iran continues to be a thorn in the side of those oppressors who seek to colonize the Middle East. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration sparked a sense of hope around the world that the war on Yemen could finally be over. For those on the ground, though, the bombs keep falling. Food is scarce and hope is in the short supply, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "This is Yemen after Biden declared an end to American support for the war." Stay tuned for the details, please. Seated next to his 13-year-old daughter, Hakima's bed in Thawra Hospital, Al-Hanishi watches a breaking news report on a small TV screen announcing that the President of the United States has announced an end to U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on his country. But Al-Hanishi took the news with skepticism. The Biden said he will end support to Mohammed bin Salman, but will help Saudi Arabia to defend herself. "Come on," said Al-Hanishi, who asked that only his first initial and tribal surname be used for fear of reprisal. Al-Hanishi now lives in Dubi village in Yemen's Nim district, about 25 miles east of Sana'a, after living for years as an internally displaced person in the country's capital. He remembers the moment that the war on his country was first announced from a podium in Washington, D.C., by Adel Al-Jubeir, the former Saudi ambassador to the United States, and he believes just as it began in Washington, the war can only end from there.